Okay, I'll be able to find it.
I just seen that Bill's looking at the official plan maps, not the zoning maps. My question is, I don't see the official plan maps posted here, the updated version. Is there any changes in the official plan maps?
Not significant in any way, shape, or form. So the critical map for Bill would be the zoning map, because that's the non-sort of interpretive map. That would be the black and white one. So old official plan maps tended to be more broad brush, and whereas the zoning maps tend to be specific lines. So I can look at both those aspects.
So I'm not just talking applicable to Bill's property, I'm talking about the township. If there's been changes, you said not significant. If there's been changes in the official plan maps, why are they not posted?
Well, they were posted on the website. They're available.
I'm just wondering why post the zoning maps and not the official plan.
Well, the meaningful maps truly are the zoning maps. The policy intent that occurs on the official plan maps are important, but they weren't changed in any, I don't believe, in any significant way other than correcting certain features, like road names or whatever. But they're on the website.
They can be made available.
Oh, yeah. We can actually produce them that way.
Oh, sure.
And if that
sounds like in Mr. Hodden's instance, it was pretty significant.
Well, we'll check that.
If the EP has moved over that far, it sounds like a significant change.
My name is Dave Stutable. I'm just following up a further question and comment with regard to the cap on the number of lots in the township. I was actually quite surprised to hear John's answer that there isn't a cap, because I always heard that there was a cap on the lake, that there was some sort of provincial formula that, based on the number of acres of water on the lake, or, the surface area, or hectares or acres, there was some number and some sort of maximum number of lots that could be developed on the lake. That's always been my understanding over all the years. And I'm a little surprised to find out that there isn't a cap now. The reason that I'm bringing it up is that this lake has a lot of pressure, right? We have Tate's Island, right, with 300 or 400 lots / cottages on them. And, there's a causeway that was built over there. And so, a traditional lake doesn't have that many properties on an island to increase the pressure on the lake. And the second reason it's important is so much of this lake was developed in the 60s. You were talking about 45-meter lots and 60-meter lots and 90-meter lots. Well, everything in the 60s was 100-foot lots. Almost all of Tate's Island is 100-foot lots. The subdivision I'm in, which is Deerfield Bay, everybody's on 100-foot lots there. There's probably 500 or 600 100-foot lots on this lake. And so because of the small lot size when the lake was first developed and the pressure of the island, I'm concerned personally about the number of lots on this lake. I always slept well at night thinking that there was a cap. I'm just hearing tonight that there wasn't a cap, but there's so much pressure into, there's fishing pressure, there's water quality pressure, there's boating pressure, and if you simply allow, back up, okay, sorry. Perfect. If you simply allow more lots to be developed based on, some 90-meter, 300-foot standard, I can tell you, driving around this lake an awful lot in my boat, there are huge swaths of undeveloped property on this lake. You could easily develop hundreds more on this lake and cause all sorts of pressure. You said there's not that many areas where they're undeveloped. There are huge tracts of land on this lake that if you simply had 300-foot lots, an awful lot of additional lots, hundreds of them in my opinion, could be developed. And so when did that change? When all of a sudden did the cap go away, and is there any consideration to reconsidering that past decision and putting caps back on the lake so as to eliminate future pressure on the lake?
Yeah, there's quite a history. I mean, the first minimum lot size for McKellar didn't happen until 1984. So the 100-foot lots occurred when there were no rules. And it wasn't until 1971 when something called universal subdivision control was triggered in the province, so that you had to approve any new lots. But even then, there were no standards in McKellar until it passed the first, what was called an existing land use bylaw in 1984, where they introduced the 150-foot lot. And over the years, there's been two key parameters to consider lot limitations in terms of lake capacity. One was a chemical one, where there was an assumption that all of the phosphorus, which is a nutrient, in septic systems would migrate to the water and cause a degradation of the lake. So they set up a lake capacity system that said, if you want to prevent lakes from getting polluted to essentially an undesirable level, you would limit the number of new lots, because each lot introduced more nutrient, that being phosphorus, into the water body. Well, they found in the last 35 years that hypothesis was not true. So that whole lake capacity issue based on the chemical phosphorus was actually erroneous. So that was the chemical concern. Now, what they have found out, the new septic systems actually do not, in our particular geography, migrate the chemical to the water. So it's the old 45-gallon drums that break down and you have pollution getting into the water still, but as long as you have a new system, that capacity assumption is no longer an issue. The planners of the past had examined the what I would call the social part of it, which is the number of boats, and they based that on the surface area. And the model was crudely, essentially, for every 4 acres of surface area, that would accept one unit of shoreline development. And so they divided the surface area of the lake by 4 acres, and based on the size of the lake, you got a capacity number. Well, we did that study in McKellar, and we got significant pushback from, as I described earlier, a number of people saying it was too foamy, it was too fudgy. And that, you know, I look out my window, and if I see there's too much traffic, I won't go to my boat. So it was pushed back fairly hard. And in today's world, the science on social indicators based on the surface area of water is leaning towards it's not really that good a science. Now, the NIMBYs, not suggesting anyone here might be judged as one, but I don't like them, because they feel that the capacity is something that we want to close the door, everyone's in. The other element of this is that, you know, to have a standard so high that no further lots can be created is abundantly unfair to those that never did develop their land. And we can't make the assumption that land, everybody who owns that land is going to necessarily develop it, but should they be penalized because they didn't build the 300 or 200 or 150 or 100. I think that's an important element when you look at the demand. As a planner, you look at all the various interests in terms of the public's objective here. So there's a whole pile of history, and I kind of grew up from the very beginning, and I'm trying to understand it from the end, but it's changed a lot. and that's where we are today. We're in a different world. And that world is, look, you have to have a premium sized lot, and 300 feet is a pretty good sized piece of property. And what will that bring in terms of additional load on the lake? It's probably not going to be that perceptible. There'll be some, for sure. I don't know whether it'll be 200, but there'll be some. Long answer, sorry.
Okay. No, I think there, even at 300 foot lots, you have the ability to generate hundreds of additional lots if that were the case. And there's more to pressure than just potential phosphorus out of the septic tank and boats, right? There's pressure on roads, there's pressure on municipal services, there's pressure on healthcare. There's all sorts of pressures everywhere, and some of it is, sometimes it's just nice to be able to get in your boat and see a long tract of land that isn't developed with a cottage every 100 feet.
Gordon Zinnock. I just have a few questions, John, and statements. John, the septic systems are designed for 12 months of use a year at full capacity. Is that not correct?
Yes, that's the requirement under the building code. There's no distinction between seasonal dwellings and year-round dwellings. So the only standard that applies is year-round.
System design 24 hour use, as I was saying, eh? All year round, full family use, washing machines, etc.
Correct.
So the amount of chance of them leaking 10% of phosphorus used 2 or 3 months a year would be almost impossible. Correct?
Modern systems seem to have the effect of not causing the presumed plume of nutrient going to the adjacent water body. An interesting sidebar, that assumption still is valid on a limestone geography. So south of the shield, that plume is being actually calibrated as entering the adjacent water bodies, but in our Canadian shield, with its highly acidic and mineralized soil, the phosphorus binds right under the bed, and it does not hit the surface waters.
One other thing on the septics. To my knowledge, I used to install them for quite a few years. I think North Bay, Mattawa, before they can do anything, the system has to be at fault. There has to be something wrong. If they come on the property, to my knowledge, and there's no leakage, no nothing, then they can't do anything about it because the system apparently is working.
Yeah, there has to be obvious signs of failure, for sure, or else they will not act.
On the setbacks, the setback issue, somebody wanted 30 meters back, and as the gentleman said, some of the lots are only 100 feet wide now, so it's that way, like, having the distance of the width of all the lots on Knight Island back from your dwelling. And I'm afraid if the setback is too great, then the house will be put back and the septic will go in front of it instead of behind it. In some instances, it should be where possible or something, just the realities of the lots. You know what I mean? But that's just a proposal. That's not been decided on council at 30 meters yet.
We did get submissions on Sunday that we should increase our 10-meter... called the front yard between the shoreline and the cottage. Keep in mind that septics have to be a minimum of 15 meters under the building code. What we've found over the years is correct that you want, if you can, to have that setback on the septic system as far as possible, but more importantly, we found that the more you set something back, that the more cottagers tended to, or other year-round residents, for that matter, would clear cut because they want to see the water. A good example was the small subdivision on limestone, which is in our neighboring municipality, but virtually after we put 100-foot, 30-meter setback, every tree was denuded in the front yards. And it's the critical part of maintaining a retention or a remediation of anything getting to the water is to preserve as much vegetation in the front yard as you can. So it gets counterintuitive. The farther you go back, the worse it gets.
Thank you. One question on cottage rentals. Just, will this hurt the established or commercial businesses who've got higher costs on short-term rentals?
Well, that was always a valid concern. I think what most of my dialogue with operators was they just wanted control. Because if you were allowed to go crazy on residents without any control, that was the worst part of their business. And so most of them didn't. And they do have much higher standards, whether it's walls, ceilings, floors. When you're designated commercial in the building code, and I got it, but it didn't seem to be driving the bus, so to speak. It was all for the issue over controlling these things.
Okay, thank you.
Hi, Amy. Debbie Sweetman. Regarding the large plots of land and possibly subdividing them, is there so many lots per 100 acres, or would they be done plan of subdivision, or any idea what the specifications are?
Well, the general rule is that if you're creating more than three lots in one particular application or proposal,
then you have to go plan.
Then you go by plan of subdivision, and then you meet the standards.
Right.
So if you had, let's say you had 3,000 feet of shoreline, uh-huh. I'm using imperial units here, you'd get 10 lots. But the reality is probably 30% or more of that might be constrained,
yeah.
Whether it be some significant heritage feature or some physical constraint. So you're probably going to have those 10 lots discounted, three or four.
So it's more plan of subdivision.
Yeah.
Yeah, and would there be... like I know when we do plan subdivisions and stuff, like you have to, you know how they do like dedicated parkland, obviously you wouldn't do that here. Would the owner be responsible for, you know, road standards?
Oh yes. And we on a subdivision we would probably take parkland. We don't do it on consents because they're smaller parcels, but the Planning Act doesn't discriminate. You can take 5% parkland on any land division application.
Right. So mostly it'd be for larger lots, it would be a draft plan subdivision, basically.
Yeah, mostly.
Because normally it's 2 plus the original. I guess that's remote, right?
Yeah, which is now all 3 plus the original. They're both waterfront and rural are both 3 plus the original.
It's part of it, sir.
3 plus the retained.
Thank you.
Thank you. I'm not sure we should even be talking about septic for this meeting, but anyway. I'm not sure we should even be talking about septic systems at this meeting, but anyway, on the topic of septic systems, it isn't just the bed that's designed, it's the tank also.
That mic, I'm not sure it's working. There. Good.
Oh, no. It's not just the septic bed itself, it's designed based on the number of occupants, the floor area, and the number of fixture units. It's also the tank. So the tank is designed to hold so much capacity. So if you get too many people occupying on a weekend or that, you could flood that tank. The solids wouldn't settle out. They'd go over and flow out into the bed and flood the bed and destroy the bed.
Thank you. On Zoom, so if you want to speak, do it now.
I just want to know, did you say that you could have two residents on a rural property without dividing?
Yes, the province actually in urban areas you can have up to three, but in our area you can have what's called a secondary dwelling in your home, like a converted apartment, or one in a garage or detached structure, but you have to have the septic system big enough to accommodate additional bedrooms.
So if you built something and put a separate septic system in, it's okay?
Yes.
Okay.
Tony, that's just one of my two comments. We sent in a note to council, and I just wanted to make it public that the Manitowoc Lake Community Association strongly supported the presentation that Ms. Gant Fuller made. And the second point, it appears, Mr. Jackson, so we're interpreting science a little differently, and I don't know whether you know, we have Carl Mitchell, who's a limnologist, working on this, and it seems to me that there's a balance somewhere between setback and regulating what kind of vegetation is there that would be optimal. And I'm wondering if it's possible not to take this meeting up, but have a reasoned discussion of the science and the alternatives and see what makes sense. See what makes sense, because it, you know, talking about science should not be a political issue.
My name is Jennifer Gant Fuller. On Sunday, I advocated for the inclusion of a 30-meter setback, or I think in the official zoning bylaw that is also redlined on the website, it's called the front yard, as Mr. Jefferson mentioned. For many years, there has been a consensus on the advisability of a 30-meter development setback as being the most effective at mitigating the impacts of development on water quality. And I'm quoting from a discussion paper. So this isn't just the viewpoint of random scientists, this is a consensus. There's a discussion paper written for the Lake of Bays Township by Tunnup Consulting Limited in North Bay. When I say a 30-meter setback has been recommended as a natural vegetation buffer since 1974, when the Ministry of Natural Resources and the Ministry of the Environment formed a joint committee to look for precautionary measures to protect lakes, a 30-meter setback was recommended to apply to cottages and sewage disposal systems. According to the Shoreline Vegetative Buffer Study by the District of Muskoka in 2003, and the more recent Shoreline Vegetative Buffers Report by the Muskoka Watershed Council, dated January 2013, there has since been broad consensus from a variety of scientific studies that 30 meters was the best buffer distance in order to protect fish and other wildlife habitat. I'd like to emphasize that this is a broad consensus among scientists, and this paper was brought to my attention by a limnologist, so that's a scientist who studies lakes and their health, with whom I consult closely in my environmental work in McKellar Township. A 30-meter setback or front yard promotes stability of lake banks, so it's not only solely about phosphorus. It's to promote the stability of lake banks, promotes the maintenance of benthic communities, which are the baseline of the food chain in the lakes, and so that's another reason to have a setback. Reduces fecal coliforms, and you all know that we've had E. coli issues in the township, especially with heavy torrential rains this summer. And that the speculation is that those torrential rains will increase with climate change, because climate change involves the temperature in the atmosphere rising, and that means that the atmosphere has a greater capacity to hold moisture, and that moisture has to come down. And so that's why we're getting the torrential rains, the increased storms in other parts of the earth. And so we have to anticipate that this is going to happen in the future. And it reduces the nutrients and sediments washed into the lake with rain runoff. So So another one issue that I want to point out is that a lot of townships not only regulate the setback, but they also regulate what's in that setback. There's been a comment that, you know, if you have a greater setback, then there's going to be clear cutting. But a lot of townships have legislated a certain percentage of the front yard needs to be planted in indigenous plants that do not require, the reason that indigenous plants are suggested is because they don't require fertilization, and they're a lot easier to care for. They have deep roots, and the deep roots are also very healthy for the environment. In the official plan, I had a difficulty finding the existing setback, and I finally realized that it was called front yard. McKellar now has a minimum frontage of 60 meters, a minimum lot area of 0.8 hectares, and a minimum setback called front yard of 10 meters for waterfront. So there is one in the zoning bylaw, the comprehensive zoning bylaw, that's also on the webpage of McKellar Township. I object to the inclusion of section 7.03.2.2, which reduces for two particular properties the lot area to 0.2 hectares. So that's much less than the usually required 0.8. The lot frontage goes down to 30 meters rather than 60, and the front yard are set back to 9 meters. And so I think that the inclusion of this exception sets a precedent for a much greater intensification of lakefront residential development than has previously been allowed, and it would not be healthy for the lake. I want to say a quick word, and it's not in my in the comments that I sent in, about septic. I was told by a Manitowabin Lake resident about a situation that happened 2 or 3 years ago where there was a breach of a septic tank, of his neighbor's septic tank. And there was, quite frankly, just raw sewage was on the ice. And two neighbors called the North Bay Mattawa Conservation Authority. They don't work on the weekend. And so they came out on Monday. Well, by Monday, the ice had melted and you couldn't see the sewage anymore. So even though these neighbors had pictures and were testifying to the representative of North Bay Mattawa, he said that there was nothing he could do about it and nothing was in fact done about it. And so I think that really looking carefully at what North Bay Mattawa can do is very important. Manitowabin Lake did experience a small bloom of blue-green algae in 2020. A lake capacity study conducted in Manitowabin Lake in 2021 by Dr. Carl Mitchell and his associates from the University of Toronto concluded that increased removal of shoreline vegetation and the presence of older, unkept septic systems were two of the reasons cited for the increased potential of future algae blooms in the lake. So just to emphasize that, the new septic building codes, the new rules, will allow it's either 90 or 99% of the phosphorus to be retained. But for the most part, we have older septic systems, and we have no mandatory inspection system, which partly is because we're not in a drinking water protected zone. And if you'll just indulge me for a moment, after the contamination in, what was the name of the town, starts with a W, Waterton, the province set up drinking water protection zones. And so the North Bay Mattawa area has a drinking water protection zone, and they have mandatory inspections of everybody's septic system within every 5 years, and there are rules of how close you can be to a septic before you can draw water, and that kind of thing. So because we're close to North Bay Manawag, they do inspect our septics, but because we're not in the same watershed, the drinking water protection zones are set up according to watersheds, and we're not in the watershed of North Bay Manawag, so we don't have a drinking water protection zone. So it's up to us to protect our own drinking water. The dividing line between area that does have a drinking water protection zone and the area that doesn't is actually right in between Sundridge and South River, which, so it's not a geographic thing, it's a watershed thing. So I just wanted to point that out. But in recent years, it's been noticed by the Lake Parker Program that there have been blue-green algae blooms, even when there is a fairly low level of phosphorus or medium level in the teens. And we did experience a small bloom of blue-green algae in 2020. And so, I lost myself here. Anyway, and so it's important that we have increased shoreline vegetation to protect the lake. It's important that we take note of the fact that we do have older septic systems. Many of the residents of the lake shore and also the residents of the town of McKellar take their water out of the lake. Not as many people have wells as take their water out of the lake. So the prospect of having a blue-green algae bloom in the future is of great concern to me. There's no treatment present in residences at this point in time that could remove the toxins. The toxin is called microcystin that may or may not be produced by a blue-green algae bloom. It can't be. The Ministry of the Environment is very sensitive now to reports of blue-green algae blooms. They come up the next day and they report immediately whether or not you have microcystin in the blue-green algae bloom. If we did, we would all be buying our drinking water. Everybody who takes their water out of the lake would have to buy their water until that blue-green algae bloom is gone. And the study shows that there is the level of toxin has gone down to a safe level. So it's a very, very, very important environmental aspect to the setback, but it's also very important for our health. And in addition, when there is a blue-green algae bloom and is producing toxin, the lake can't swim in the lake, and you have to keep the animals out of the lake, whether they're farm animals or dogs or whatever. And I don't know what happens to the wild animals that are in the lake. So we really have to be very, very careful of this and not deal with it lightly. And that's my submission for this evening. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Susan Keane, I mentioned this to you, Your Worship, but in case this is an official place to do it, with respect to the concern about septics and the age of them in the community, I would imagine if the township were to put something in place to license everybody or to inspect everybody's, it would be like a massive job. And this is concerning older properties, but when, I wonder if it's possible to have a consideration that every time a property changes hands, i.e. when it's sold, that the septic needs to be inspected at that point. So over time, it's not going to solve anything immediately, but over time, as properties change hands, there could be at least some assurance that some older properties' septics have been looked at and possibly repaired, because you know we have all heard of situations like this where there are problems. So I just sort of throw that out officially on the record.
Yeah, the mayor is mentioning that condition can sometimes be placed upon a seller when it's acquiring the property, but I don't think we can actually enforce that. But there is a septic reinspection program that we can ask to have implemented by North Bay Manawag. It used to be, 20 years ago, it used to be something the province would do based on its resources. I think they will do it now, but at a cost. So North Bay will do a reinspection, but I think there's now an associated cost, so maybe we can inquire what's involved in the new septic reinspection process. Many municipalities have gone through that.
Just to comment on that, Mr. Jackson, Tony Best again. Some years ago, I made a presentation on septic to the previous council, and the conclusion was that Manawal was horrendously expensive and not the option to consider, not even within the realm of remote possibility. So that's shut down as an option.
Okay, that answers the question.
Maybe not, because my best friend has a cottage in Minden Hills.
A name again?
Douglas Hunt.
Thank you.
And they've just finished they're coming to an end of this 5-year period of every septic tank in that township being inspected and receiving a pass or a fail. Pass, you don't have to do anything. Fail, it's mandatory that you replace your septic system. And my friend he had a 50-year-old system and was forced to put in a new system. So that option is alive and well in Ontario. And Minden Hills is the township that participated in that. I'm not sure who paid for what, who enforces what, but he had official notices come to him through the township, and he was required to follow them. That program works.
Thank you.
Just a little bit more information on that. I think the problem with McKellar, Whitestone, this area, we're all mandated under the building code to have our inspections through North Bay Mattawa. So a reinspection program has to go through them. Where Doug's talking about, I'm sure the municipality forced the septic systems in the building code there. So any monies that were generated from new permits for updating systems, putting in new systems, the municipality got that money. We wouldn't, North Bay Mattawa would.
Thank you.
Jennifer Gant Fuller, just an addition. When we considered, as part of the Environment Committee a few years ago, whether or not to institute a mandatory inspection program, the issue was that we don't have in McKellar the documentation about when the septics were put in. And in order to get that, so the idea would be, you know, to look at the oldest and septic systems first. But in order to get the data of when the septic systems were put in, at that point in time, we would have to pay North Bay Mattawa $70 per septic system in order to get that information, which, you know, for 1,600 places, that's pushing, you know, between $150,000 and $200,000. And so it just made it financially unfeasible to do that. So something would have to be figured out in terms of how do we get the information about how old a septic system is before having a mandatory inspection program. So just thought I'd add that in.
Thank you.
Just to add to my friend's situation from his township, it cost him $500 to have a inspection done. He paid the costs upfront to some company in Mississauga, I think, and they sent out people to examine each and every septic system, and then that report went to the township, I understand. But I would suggest you could contact the Hinden Hills Township and see exactly how they implemented their inspections and got all their systems up to date.
Can I ask you a question?
Oh,
is this waterfront properties or
to the
every
property?
Every
property.
I just want to I just want to say from experience that the township did have and should have very good records on septics. Every use permit that was issued from either the Ministry of the Environment or a contract company that worked for them over the years, right up to North Bay Mattawa, the municipality was given copies of them. And whenever I started working for the township back in the 90s, they were all in one big box, and I had the owner's task of depositing them all into the specific property files, so they should be in there.
Okay, I'm just not sure what the files are right now, but we shall investigate.
How do we feel about leaching pits?
No.
Because there are cottages that change hands that have leaching pits. So I don't know if there's any sort of bylaw or something that maybe once it changes hands, it should be.
Could I ask you, when you say leaching pit, are you talking privy?
Pardon me?
Are you talking about a privy or an outhouse?
Sewage agreement, very well.
I think.
Anyway, an outhouse is a legitimate form of.
Yeah, no, this is from a cottage. And it went into like
holding
a
tank.
A leaching pit, holding tank, yeah, that little
holding
tank. Holding tank, just.
You have to get the pump down.
Yeah, no, that was a pit. But I think it's been changed since. I didn't know if there was anything that there was. Like, they're still allowed holding tanks and stuff?
No. They have, in a very limited sort of emergency situation, they will allow a holding tank, but the province is very much...
So is there something that, say, you know, people probably wouldn't know about it, because say it's been in the family for whatever, but then it goes on market and it changes hands. So I don't know if there's anything that would be a law that if you have that, you should change it. Just an idea.
Yeah, I think that was touched upon, I think, when the mayor said some purchasers, advisors, counselors suggest that they get a full profile of whatever service is available on a property. That's still available.
Okay, I'm sure you're all interested. Questions from Zoom, whoever's on there, we still have 18. So, Carter, you're still back there? Oh, okay. So again, just have your name stated, please, and raise the hand, too, so that she can tell who wishes to speak.
Sue Poff, if you want to unmute.
Good evening, everyone. Sorry I can't be there in person. My name is Sue Poff, and I'm part of the Lake Stewardship Environmental Committee. And I just wanted to elaborate a bit more on what Jennifer Ginn-Fuller has spoken about. So I'm a professional landscaper and gardener, and one of the volunteer activities I do in the Lake Manitobobbing area is I go out and do shoreline restoration. With some clients, it's through the MLCA, so there's another person and I who are subject experts in the area. And so I just wanted to mention that the planner had mentioned that people, if the setback is further, they'll clear cut. And we're finding they're already doing that. So if they are clear cutting back further, like Jennifer said, if we put into the policy that they need to leave some vegetation lakeside, I think that would go a long way in helping our lake system. And so a lot of my work is I go in and I help clients revegetate that area because they're finding that there's soil erosion and that sort of thing. Anyway, I just wanted to say my little piece there, and I support having a further setback. Thank you so much.
Okay, thank you.
Anyone else on Zoom? Leslie Rich, you can unmute.
Thank you. Thank you, members of council. I just, for the, I guess, formal record, wanted to let you know that I did have the opportunity to speak with the planner after the session on Sunday, and I did raise some concerns related to the natural hazard component of the special climate and zoning bylaw in particular. So I believe that he's going to follow up with that based on our conversation, but I can provide more detailed comments if that would be helpful. But there's two things that I want to kind of draw to the attention of the group. So first of all, in the zoning bylaw, there is a proposed definition for floodplain, I believe, and floodway, and that those are not consistent with the definitions that are found in the provincial policy statement. And generally, planning authorities are to identify hazardous lands and hazardous sites within their municipality. I know, obviously, that we don't have engineered floodplain mapping for the township of McKellar, but I wanted to flag that for you all, knowing that you are sending this to the Ministry of Municipal Affairs and Housing and expecting additional comments from the Ministry of Natural Resources. Just you could perhaps get started on updating the official plan and zoning bylaw to be more consistent with natural hazard policies and the provincial policy statement. Thank you.
Well, Leslie, it's John speaking. Thank you for that. I did take some notes, but it might be helpful if you would send Carly just a quick email so that I know exactly. It sounds like your technical background is better than mine for this issue, so that would be greatly appreciated. Thank you.
My pleasure. Thanks.
Chris Happ, you can unmute.
Thanks, Carly. Yeah, my name is Chris Hapke. John, during the working meeting, I phoned in and asked about the Ontario had upped the minimum or maximum size of a shed or ancillary building up from 108 square feet to 160 square feet to build without a permit. You'd mentioned you'd jot that down, but I didn't see it in the redlined version.
If it's not there, Chris, I'll make a note to check. And yes, January 1, 2022, no building permit is required for a shed now that is under 15 square meters, which works out to about 160 square feet, whereas it previously was 10 square meters, which was 108, but we should update that.
Thank you very much. I have another quick question just about Section 4 for the Rural Zone 4.01 uses permitted. So this is for rural. You guys have added both a modular home and a transportable prefabricated dwelling unit as acceptable, I guess, buildings. Is that just for rural and not applicable to any of the residential or waterfront 2 zone? And I guess, is that subject to minimum 700 square feet that I think you guys have? Primary
dwelling? The modular home, I think, is something that would be allowed in any residential zone. I'm going to have to check on the minimum size of the structure because of the Planning Act changes recently that do sort of limit the restrictions that the municipality can impose on residential dwellings, which I think actually may no longer exist, so I'm going to check that as well, so thanks for that.
Awesome, thank you. And then, sorry guys, really one last question. For the creation, you guys mentioned of bringing the rural in line with the waterfront where you can add the creation of three new lots. Is that three in addition to the retention of the original lot? So basically at the end of the day, you're left with four?
Correct.
Or is it three at the end? Okay.
No, that's correct, three and one.
Awesome, thank you.
Sean Fleming, you can unmute.
Thank you very much. I just wanted to take a moment to advocate on behalf of the short-term rentals. I have a company called Serenity Vacation Rentals, and we manage some properties up in your area as well as other parts of the province. And one of the most important things for us is responsible management. We are registered with TECO, the Travel Industry of Canada. Travel Industry Council of Ontario as a government requirement. We are also the Ontario Cottage Rental Managers Association. And we, working with cottages in other municipalities, we do have licensing plans, requirements. We have worked with them. And as a responsible manager of short-term rental cottages, I can tell you that all of the members of our organization, including us, follow all of the rules. So I know there were some concerns about septic tanks and number of people in a cottage and all of that. And as responsible managers, we do take all of that into consideration, and we do mandate a specific number of people allowed into a cottage. We do monitor that. We monitor noise levels. In our contracts, we have it specifically set out that noise must cease by a specific time at night and cannot start before the morning, as well as following the rules around the outdoor fires and whatnot. So I just wanted to quickly speak to that, and further to what Axie said earlier, advocate on behalf of responsible cottage rentals. Thank you.
Anyone else on Zoom have a question?
Back in the public here. Anybody want to be the last speaker? You don't have to be the last one, just if anybody else has any comments. I'll maybe just ask, John, I don't want to put you on the spot here, but the process from here on.
Thank you, Member. Hope is that the province will stick to the 90 days. They have a terrible track record. So this may drag into October or November. I'm hoping that it won't go beyond this year, but in an ideal world, we could have the official enacting meeting after we have a working session with the submissions with council and have a document that's ready to be adopted sometime earlier, mid-October, and notices will be on the website with respect to following up on that process. So cross our fingers, and we should be in good shape in a couple of months.
And you mentioned 120 days.
Well, there is a period where the province has an opportunity to review the formal document of 120 days. Why they would need that would be surprising to me, because it's quite likely that we're going to, in fact, include any of their suggested changes, because they suggested them 4 or 5 years ago, and we agreed then. So I don't think they'll need the 120 days, but the Planning Act gives them 120 days to make a decision. Now, after this process is complete, McKellar will have its own autonomy and be responsible for its own approvals for policy changes. So it's going to be worth it in the end, in my view. But sometimes the province doesn't act as quickly as we'd like.
And again, not wanting to put you on the spot, but I will. We're getting conflicting information on Bill 185. And how do you interpret that one about appeals?
The Ford government, for those that have been watching, will know that the object of plain changes to the Planning Act have come fast and furious. Some of them have been walked back, which seems to be a commonality of the government of today, but there are only appeals allowed by specified bodies, which tend to be agencies or utilities, for example, or the municipality itself. They made one change on the ability to appeal to registered owners that make submissions prior to the enactment of the of the bylaws, so long as that the changes affect that property owner. So they tried to eliminate all appeals in the hope of creating more housing opportunities, but that last change has established a very unclear path for anyone to appeal a comprehensive bylaw. But I think the sense would be that unless there was a specific concern to a specific property owner, that it would not likely be available for any kind of formal appeal. So we're not entirely clear on that, but we're hoping that we satisfy all concerns, whether they're agencies, property owners, or other interests in this exercise.
Any questions from the public on what John just said? If not, yes. Oh, somebody online?
Yes. Mr. Mayor, it's Fred Burleson.
Yes, go ahead. Go ahead.
The answer to Land Tribunal has not been amended. Anyone can seek party status before the tribunal, except the tribunal can decide whether or not they have party status. The other matter, with respect, Mr. Chair, is has council adopted an official plan amendment and a zoning bylaw amendment? The statute indicates that the approved or adopted official plan amendment should be forwarded to the minister, and at that point in time, the 90-day period starts. That's all I have to say.
Okay, thank you. We're trying to get the information from the public. I think that's why we haven't adopted anything yet. That'll be down the road, but that's good information. Thank you. Okay, if nothing else, thank you for coming out. We appreciate that, your concern, your interest, and the meeting is now adjourned. Stay tuned to the website if there's further information.